We're going to switch gears and take a break from the news for our conversation today, although who knows, the John Edwards trial might make its way in because everything else does when you're talking to New Yorker staff writer Adam Gopnik, who can go from French resistance fighters to Ferran Adrià's molecular gastronomy movement in Spain to Sylvester the Cat and Spencer for Hire often in one sentence. His most recent book is The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food. And Adam Gopnik joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Adam, welcome.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here.
And I know we've actually, I know that you just got there.
You've been fighting. It was like in a bad romantic comedy, you know, where the Matthew McConaughey character is racing across 42nd Street to the Drew Barrymore character.
I ran
through traffic with everyone honking their horns and, you know, perfect extra taxi guys shouting at me.
Well,
just
we're
to be
thrilled
here with you.
You're there. Thank you so much. And, you know, I was thinking in preparing to talk to you, everything does make its way into this new book. Politics, for instance, are in the book. Let's start there, because you say in France, opinions on food cut across political lines. But in America and England, you are what you think about eating. What do you mean?
Well, don't you find that to be true? In other words, if I'm on the road, as I am a lot, and somebody invites me over for supper, I usually know within 30 seconds of the first thing that's served as you come through the door what these folks' politics are. If you get an organic, locally grown carrot with a little sprinkle of fleur de sel, you know how much money they gave to Obama last time, how much less they're going to give to him this time, so on. Now, the curious thing is that's not true in quite the same way in France, because in France, a taste for the slow, you know, terroir, the soil, the organic, that can very often be a right-wing, very reactionary taste, because it's all about defending French character in the French nation.
Well, let's stay with France, because that's sort of the overarching point you make in this wonderful new book. You start off with the story of a French resistance fighter. 3 hours before he was to face the Nazi firing squad in 1942, mm-hmm. he writes a letter to his girlfriend's parents. Now, you were just talking about how in modern times we're obsessed with, do you eat meat, do you not eat meat, organic, not paper, plastic, you know. Mm-hmm. But he had a big thought about food. What was he writing?
You know, this is the last letter he writes in his life to his parents. And instead of, his name is Jacques Decoeur, and instead of writing about the solidarity of France or the national spirit or something, he says to them, I want you to remember the great meals we've shared together. I want you to be sure that you get the menu from the auberge that we went to my girlfriend. And he ends this letter by saying, questions of food, as you see, have taken on great importance. And that became for me sort of like the koan in Zen, the question that I wanted to try and answer or at least explore throughout this book. Why do questions of food take on great importance? Exactly as you said a moment ago, everything seems to come to the table. Our politics, our erotic life, our family life all seem to gather around there. So when Jacques Decoeur was saying that, he wasn't just saying questions of food have taken on great importance because where shall we go to eat Saturday night? He wasn't going to have a Saturday night. He was saying the questions of food have taken on great importance for some reason that's more mysterious. And then finally for me is, to use a big word or a small word with a big meaning, is about the humane side of life, about everything that makes us human.
Yeah, he says, we have crosstalk and cable clatter, but he had a sense of what makes us human. But that might be a surprise to people who think, wait a second, I don't think food can ever have been more important because of all the cable clatter and all the cookbooks and all the different questions we have to ask ourselves before we eat.
Food has never been noisier and louder in our lives, that's for sure. But I think it's always been important. And in some ways, the noise of it reduces our ability to hear its real music, as so often happens. Can you imagine anything more inherently paradoxical than the notion that you would have entire cable channels devoted to showing you food that you cannot taste, cannot smell, or cannot actually sensually enjoy in any way? Foods become recreation. Foods become competition. It's become macho material. You know, everybody goes off and, I don't know, braises the testicles of the Yeti on top of Mount Everest or something. But I think we can too easily lose sight of what for me is the reality, and that is that what goes on around the table matters at least as much as what is put upon the table. And that's very much the theme of this book.
Yeah. Talk about some of the history of all of this. You write the first great book about taste came from Briat Savarin. Have I got that right? 1825.
Briat Savarin, as we say across the ocean.
Yeah.
And all my French listeners now are wincing with pain as my son, who has a much better ear for French, still does. Wonderful guy. We know him because he wrote a book called Physiology of Taste, which is sort of the most famous first book ever written about gastronomy. But what's weird about it is that people think of it as a sort of little compendium of jokes and aphorisms and recipes, and it isn't at all. It's a wonderful book of liberal political philosophy in the sense that what he's saying is, look, with all of the disasters of the revolution, and Brillat Savarin had to flee the terror, and he came right here to New York City, played in an orchestra, a political refugee, goes back to France and says, look, we've had the terror, we've had the Napoleonic Wars, all these things have been disastrous, all our politics. And yet, over that same period, from about 1780 to 1820, in the heart of Paris, an entirely new civilization of pleasure had grown up, centered on the restaurant, which was a totally new invention, something that had never been there before. And Brillat Savarin says, that's our real genius. It's the soft power of what he called beautifully social gourmandise, meaning the shared delight in greed. That's where the future lies, and that's the real power of French civilization. I think he was right.
Well, hold on there a second, Adam Gopnik. You also write about, I'm going to really butcher this, Grimaud Le Reynier, another.
Very good.
thank you. And the forgotten English writer Elizabeth Pennell, the first to see the cookbook as literary. You attribute to her one of the, as you write, most magical sentences of the late 19th century. Accept the gospel of good living, and the sexual problem will be solved. What a great way to head into a break. Just briefly, a few seconds on, you mentioned the erotic things we bring to the table.
Right. Elizabeth Pennell, wonderful 19th century writer, and she calls herself a greedy woman, writes a book called Diary of a Greedy Woman. She's saying, I'm a person of appetite, not a person, not a domestic chatelaine. Great forward step.
Adam Gopnik, staff writer for The New Yorker and also author of The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food. I think it was Slate magazine that wrote that they wish that the book could have been a table and a dinner party, and Adam would have been at it. If you can't have Adam Gopnik at your dinner party, we have the next best thing. He's here with us. And Adam, we were just talking about food writer Elizabeth Pennell, one of a cast of characters that makes an appearance in your book. And one that reminded me of how I felt about M.F.K. Fisher. You know, you just sort of like swoon over the writing. But you fell out of love with her because of something she said about Jews.
I did. I was writing this series of sort of emails, imaginary emails, because how else are we going to communicate with the dead except by email, to her, because I felt that I had so much in common with her in a way. She's a woman writing at the end of the 19th century who's firmly in favor of appetite. I'm a guy at the beginning of the 21st who's taken on the feminine role in some ways of being the family cook and so on. So I was writing these letters to her, sharing recipes, imagining, comparing our two food cultures. And I discovered in a book she wrote around the turn of the last century, around 1914, that she had gone back to Philadelphia where she was born and where I was born, and she launches into this ugly, ugly diatribe against the Russian Jews who are taking over Philadelphia, and particularly the tree-named streets of Philadelphia, Pine and Locust and so on. I am a Russian Jew from Locust Street in Philadelphia. It was exactly my grandparents who she was, in this extremely ugly way, bigoted way, attacking. Mm-hmm. And for a moment I thought, well, I'm going to have to drop this whole side of the book. And then I realized in a way that that was the core question of the book. It's exactly Jacques Décor's question. Questions of food take on great importance. We all think all the time of the table as a place of inclusion, right? It's where we all come together happily. But the reality is the table's also a place of exclusion. It's a place where we say, I don't want to sit with you. And the question, who can we sit with? Who can we share with? What are the extreme edges of the possibilities of communality, if you like? Yeah. That's a big question, and it's one that I ended up addressing, and I hope it gives the book at its end a more, I don't want to say serious, but a more significant moment.
Well, on another level, very different level, but you talk about how our tastes about not who we sit with, but even what we eat change. Mm-hmm. I mean, clarified butter, melted butter with milk solid skimmed and strained. That was huge, gone now. Emulsified butter with a little water whisked in
exactly.
Is in. You know, the cult of the cooking vessel, woks and everything, gone. Salt in.
Absolutely.
You know, slow food in. Techno-emotional cooking, a movement founded by Ferran Adrià in Spain, in.
Right. We like to call that molecular cuisine, but Ferran, who's the real temperament of an artist, says, no, we cannot call it that. Techno-emotional cuisine is his name for it. Sure, you know, and that's a wonderful kind of thing. You know, that's where they do all the stuff with the sea urchin foams and the goat brain tartare and so on. The sous vide cooking, you know, where everything is boiled, which is just what my grandmother did,
right.
And my mother thought was horrible. So it's true, you know, there are these cycles of what I call mouth taste, the way it feels when we eat it, and moral taste, the emotions that we attach to the things we eat. And they do change all the time. They change radically. And the big question, I think, is, are those changes just fashions and fads? We like one thing one year and the next thing the next. We cook with a tagine now. We'll cook again with a wok tomorrow. Or do they represent real values? Are they real things that we should care about passionately? And that's a very tricky question, and it's one I try and work my way through. I think it's certainly true that anybody who tells you there is a right way to eat will look very foolish 50 years
that,
from now.
I loved that point because I know I go around thinking really superior to my relatives who might have boiled vegetables, because I don't. I steam them. But you
exactly.
say, oh, but wait, because in a few years, you will be as obsolete as, you know, the people who made in your family who made casseroles with canned soup. And that's hard to grasp.
Exactly. And casseroles with canned soup are coming back now as a kind of, you know, folk art joke. Here's the thing, and I think this is the core of it, too. Those things do change all the time, and we have to have a nice ironic attitude about it because they're just the comedy of manners, comedy of human manners. But as I say in the book, the secret of life is being able to have an ironic attitude about the constant change of manners and still be sufficiently attached to our values that they really matter to us. And underneath all those changes and all those fashions, which I try and catalog in the book, you can see that there are real enduring values, the value of the things we share, the value of common experience, the values of the table. And they are real and they are worth fighting for.
There's so much more in the book. You go to explore all the different genres of food, meat.
Went to the White House kitchens? Absolutely.
White House kitchen. You meet a man in Paris who thinks if you're going to eat meat, you have to eat every single shred of the animal. On the other hand, you want to show your children what slaughter is like because you feel they should see it. So you try to buy a chicken in New York. It's like an episode out of The Sopranos.
Exactly. I do a whacking of a chicken.
Got a chicken. But I just want to ask you briefly one thing, because again, just the range here. Writing and food. You mentioned how much you love Robert Parker's books, the Spencer for Hire books, because he created a detective who, let me see if I can remember, walks the mean streets of America with a recipe in his head.
Yeah, he has wonderful recipes, and I've tried to copy some of them. You know, it's funny. One of the things that's true is that we use in characters in fiction now often cook, where they used to go on long walks in 19th century fiction. We use cooking as a sort of a thread that enables the inner life of a character to be revealed. Ian McEwan, the wonderful English novelist, does this. Parker does this. And I have a whole chapter about the way we use the imagination of food in contemporary writing to indicate these things. I say that one of the great things, you know, Parker is a real cook because he uses actual shell beans, you know, where you actually shell the beans. It is the most laborious act of the kitchen. It's one that almost nobody except a cook notices because a shell bean and a canned bean taste very much the same. But it's a sign of a real vocation for cooking, and Parker has it.
I wanted to give that nod to the late, great Robert Parker. Adam Gotnick, we just got a few seconds here. You write, most modern cookbook writers are the sizzlist. It's like all sizzle, no soul. But just in the few seconds we have, you recommend Mark Bittman's new How to Cook Everything, you say instant classic?
Wonderful book. I love Calvin Trillin, to whom this book is dedicated, along with my wife and kids. He's a wonderful food writer. So many good people out there. You mentioned MFK Fisher. I think she still reigns because she said the wisest thing ever about food. When I write about food, I write about hunger.
Yeah, for everything. Adam Gopnik, again, a staff writer for The New Yorker, but also author of The Table Comes First, Family, France, The Meaning of Food. Adam, you know, thank you for giving us at least a taste of what it would be like to have you for a dinner guest.
Such a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks so much. Take care.